Welcome to episode 84 of the Robot Report podcast. I'm Mike Weitzman, editor of the Robot Report and founder of the Mobile Robot Guide. Steve Crow is on vacation this week with an extended July 4th holiday, so it's a solo show this week. But I want to thank all of you for tuning in. We've got you covered with our portfolio of publications, including the Robot Report, Mobile Robot Guide, Robotics Business Review, and Collaborative Robotics Trends. Today on the show, we have an interview with Brian Gerke, CEO from Open Robotics. Brian has worked on the ROS project since 2008, and he's a leader in open source robotic software. Brian was also a popular keynote presenter at the recent Robotics Summit in Boston, and Steve and I thought it would be excellent to have him on the show. So that interview will run a little bit later in the show. But now, on to some news from the week. Analog Devices launched a new 3D time-of-flight camera, and I got a chance to demo the new product and get a detailed review of the specs from Analog Devices product line director Eric Barnes while I was at the Sensors Converge event in San Jose, California earlier this week. And let me tell you what impressed me most about this new camera. First of all, was its size. It's pretty small. It's about 43 by 31 by 15 millimeters, or roughly about 2 inches by 1 inch in rough dimensions. And that's significantly smaller than any other range finding or 3D options currently on the market. The other thing that impressed me is the 1 megapixel resolution of this camera. And what you get out of the depth data. So I think there's going to be a bunch of possible applications for this device for those of you that are machine builders listening in. And, you know, for that, for example, that might include dimensioning. You could use this camera to determine the volume or size of an object that could fulfill a variety of automation needs. It could also be used for obstacle detection. Although it has a fairly short range of only 4 meters, it does have an accuracy of up to plus or minus 3 millimeters in that range. While that won't be useful for fast-moving vehicles, I think it will still have some applications. It might also, because of its size, be useful, you know, in an end effector for palletizing type of applications or robot guidance applications for a cobot or a fixed robot arm. And it also has a really good price point. Overall, a really affordable sensing option from Analog Devices. And I wrote a story about the announcement and published that earlier this week, including all of the tech specs. So if that's something that interests you, you'll find that story on the Robot Report, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes. The other story that Steve and I talked about in the episode last week was that we reported on the permitting issues for the deployment of autonomous tractors in California. And while I had the opportunity to be in San Jose earlier this week, I took a day following the show to drive an hour south of San Jose to Salinas, California. And Salinas is, you know, one of the key growing regions in California. We grow a lot of vegetables there, a lot of lettuce, a lot of those types of crops. But it's unique for another reason, in that it's super close to the Bay Area and all of the high-tech companies that are in the Bay Area. So really, it's an ideal place for an ag tech company to locate because it's close to the Bay Area. It's in the heart of one of the major growing regions, so it's a great place to test equipment. And so I reached out while I was in the region to a couple of those ag tech companies, and I had the opportunity, first of all, to see an in-field demo this week of the FarmWise Titan autonomous weeder. And I also had the opportunity to visit the factory of Stout AgTech and see how they are building the Stout autonomous weeding implement. Now, you know, it's an interesting opportunity for me because I had the chance to see both companies' technology close up and practically back to back. And they are doing similar things in that they're automating the cultivation process, which in layman's terms means, you know, the weeding of crops during the growing operation. And so both companies are employing vision cameras to look at the ground. and they've both built AI models that help identify crop plants, beneficiary plants, and weed plants. And then you use mechanical blades that are driven by, servo by motors to carve up the soil and destroy the weeds while preserving the crop and other beneficial plants. And, you know, in the context of looking at this, I really learned something in that, this problem of ag is got so many variables. It's so many dimensions to the problem. And here, for example, when you're working on a crop, not only do you want to get rid of weeds, but there are certain beneficial plants that farmers actually plant along with the crops in many cases. And an example of a beneficial plant would be something you're not going to harvest for eating, but it might be a plant that attracts the bugs, either good bugs, brings in bees or other pollinators, but it also might attract, other bugs that would destroy the crop to, actually come to the beneficial plant. So again, the part of the problem here is not only to identify crop plants and weeds or plants that you don't want to be in the ground, but also the other plants that you want to keep or preserve as well. And so, it's interesting for both of these companies, while their market strategies are completely different. And here, for example, the FarmWise Titan machine is a self-contained, specially designed tractor with this automated cultivation implement attached to it. And FarmWise, for example, offers weeding as a service. It's a RAS model. And a FarmWise operator takes the machine to the field and follows the machine through the field while steering it remotely, or they can sit on board the machine during the operation. So it's not technically in any way an autonomous tractor. So while we've talked about some of the issues with autonomous tractors now in California, the FarmWise Titan is not an autonomous tractor, and that's one of the things that I learned that I didn't really understand. So it's not impacted by any of the things that we've talked about over the last couple of weeks with these tractor permitting concerns. It always comes with an operator, and that operator is always controlling, what the machine is doing. The Stout solution, on the other hand, is built as a smart implement. So just like any of the other types of implements that would be pulled behind a human-driven tractor, the Stout solution, it falls into that class of machine. And while the implement is fully autonomous, the tractor is still driven by a human. So the Stout machine is fully autonomous for the weeding operation. Once it's attached to a tractor, the farmer simply needs to lower the implement onto the row and then begin driving down the row. And then the Stout weeder uses its onboard vision and onboard processing to ID the crop and the beneficials. And then it too autonomously carves up all of the weed plants, leaving the crop intact and the beneficials in the ground as well. Ultimately, of course, the Stout implement could be pulled behind an autonomous tractor at some point in the future, but that's not a requirement for its success. So again, I'll have stories about both of these machines and what I learned and what I saw. Those will be posted up on the Mobile Robot Guide and also to the Robot Reporter, and I'll put a link to those stories in the show notes. I also had a chance to talk with A3 President Jeff Bernstein earlier today. And one of the things that I wanted to talk to Jeff about was, he's seen it all happen here over the last two, 3 decades in the robotics industry. And again, the topic was, what he thought about this issue with the permitting of autonomous tractors. And Jeff commented that, safety around robots and automation is the number one priority for A3. And in essence, Jeff said that this is one of the reasons why A3 is such a strong advocate for the development of robot standards. And for those of you that know what A3 does, their standards bodies and supportive standards development is a core part of what they do for the industry. And really what that does is it enables end users, companies that buy automation, of course, all the government agencies that follow the deployment in all the various regions for all the various industries, and also the robotic development companies allows them to all get on the same page for what's safe and what's not. And, you know, Jeff commented that he's seen, you know, a similar cycle around the development of both industrial and collaborative robots, as well as indoor mobile robots over the last couple of decades. And he believes that this is just a normal part of the cycle as industry, as government come together to define, you know, the rules for any new type of automated piece of equipment.
All right, Mike, we're going to talk a lot about the robot operating system today, also known as ROS, of course. Really, no better person in the world, I don't think, to help us do that. We're joined now by Brian Gerke. He's the co-founder and CEO of Open Robotics. Of course, Open Robotics driving the development and adoption of ROS and open source technologies for robotics development and research. Prior to Open Robotics, he worked at Willow Garage, SRI, Stanford University, USC. Brian delivered the opening keynote at our recent Robotics Summit and Expo, focusing a lot on interoperability, which we'll certainly touch on throughout this discussion. Brian, again, thanks again for delivering that keynote. Hope you enjoyed the show. How you doing, sir?
Hi, Steve. Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. And yeah, thanks for giving me the opportunity to do the keynote at your event in Boston. That was fun.
Yeah. Well, it was a great show overall. So thanks again. I want to start here. Open Robotics recently celebrated its 10-year anniversary. I think ROS last month turned 13. You guys came out at ICRA 13 years ago, and you've really been there since the beginning, even a little before that, going back to your work creating the open source player project. But you guys wrote an article celebrating the 10-year anniversary, and this quote I thought was fantastic. So I thought it could be a good place to start and just sort of let you have a chance to encapsulate the journey that you've been on the last, whatever, 13 plus years. Here's the quote, quote, 10 years later, here we are, an overnight success, a decade in the making, end quote, which I thought was fantastic. So just tell us about the journey that it's been developing ROS in open source and open robotics. Sorry.
Yeah, that sounds about right. An overnight success 10 years later. So, you know, I started, as you mentioned, I started working on open source robot software in the late 90s as part of what became the Player Stage project when I was a grad student. And that was really where I developed my personal passion for building tools that allow people to do what they want to do with robots. And that was, it was always a bit of a struggle when I was in grad school, because I was supposed to be doing science and developing algorithms and writing papers, but I really had just got far more satisfaction out of building the software infrastructure that you needed to do all that work. And so then fast forward several years and the opportunity came along to move over to Willow Garage and run the software engineering team there as they were getting started on the ROS project. And this was building on a lot of work that my now colleague Morgan Quigley had done in during his PhD time at Stanford. And the original mission was, we're going to build this robot, which was the PR2. And we want this robot to get out into labs and we want people to use it, but we also want it to come with great software. And we want that software to be open source so that everybody can do everything that they need to do with it. We want it to be really flexible. And that was pretty much the mandate at the beginning. We're going to make a robot. We're going to make some software for it. But we were careful along the way to make sure that we didn't make that software too specific for the PR2, and with the hope that maybe other people would use it. And, you know, this is one of those things I like to quote. There's a quote that's attributed to Jimmy Wales about Wikipedia. It doesn't work in theory. It only works in practice. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think this is a case like that, where you put all the software out there, you make it completely open, and you hope for the best. And much to our surprise, there were already robots running ROS before we even got the PR2 out the door, because it turns out it takes longer than you think to make a robot. Well, there were other robots out there already running ROS. And then we got the PR2 out there. We had a big debut at ICRA in Anchorage, which I think was 2010. And from there, it took a while, but we got to critical mass. And that's why now, you know, 10 years later, we can look at the really having established a de facto standard across the robotics industry, which is I think it's a huge feather in the cap of the whole community that did all this work along that period of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so now you've
just released you. I mean, ROS is now in version 2, or ROS 2, as it's known, right? And so a major, you know, set of new features with ROS 2. And I think as I've watched the industry sort of evolve, I mean, a lot of products built around ROS 1, some of those commercial products now as well. And with ROS 2 coming out, there's been a lot of anticipation. What the recent release of what's it called, Humble Hawksbill, the most recent long-term supported release. So tell us a little bit about that evolution from, you know, what ROS 1 brought to market is some of those core features, and now what ROS 2 has brought to the market, and how you see that adoption going forward.
Sure. So, you know, as I alluded to, when we got started with ROS in the early days, which we now call ROS 1, we had a particular user in mind who was really a researcher. We had in mind a researcher in a lab. And what that person wanted more than anything else was flexibility. And that's what we emphasized throughout the whole code base. But that meant that we didn't necessarily emphasize things like a set of requirements that can be traced back into the code, or having security built into the system, or thinking about what does the reliability and uptime of the system look like. So those were not priorities that we had in the design. Now, it so happens that one of my favorite questions I get from people is, well, is ROS ready for production? And I say, well, you know, go into pretty much any warehouse that has robots in it that are not Amazon's robots, and you'll get your answer. You have AMRs running in production 24/7 around the world. So absolutely, despite the fact that we frankly did not design for it, companies have been very successful in deploying ROS in production for many, many years now. And so that's well settled. Having said that, there are some domains where ROS, as we originally designed it, was not suitable. And here we're thinking about aerospace applications, automotive applications, medical applications, cases where you've got a mission critical task to do. And it's in fact less about the ability of the system to do that task than it is about your ability to convince yourself and your customers and your regulators that the system will do that task safely. And that's a case where ROS 1, given its history of development, we saw it as just too high of a bar to take that system through the kinds of certification or verification and validation processes that you need to go through to get deployed into those settings. So we decided several years ago, let's start back at square one and take what we've learned over, by that time, more than, you know, 6-7 years of experience with ROS 1 and a bunch of feedback we got from our users in the community, and let's build ROS 2 in a way that we want to preserve all the good features that we had in ROS 1, including flexibility. But now we want to build in security. We want to build in things like quality of service on sending messages around. We want to make the system amenable to being run in a deterministic or real-time fashion. We want to have the design and the implementation be in such a state that it would be possible to take that system through a certification process. And so now, you know, you look several years after that, we've now been developing ROS 2 since 2015, I want to say. And as you mentioned, we just put out the ROS 2 Humble release. That's our latest long-term support release. Came out in May. It'll be supported for, 5 years. And now we've got significant industry participation in it. We convened the ROS 2 Technical Steering Committee a couple of years ago. You can see we've got everybody from, we've had everyone from chip manufacturers to cloud providers to robot manufacturers to robot end users participating in this technical steering committee, where they're putting in their own engineering time to evolve ROS 2. And they're doing that out of self-interest. They're doing that because they see in ROS 2 something that they need for their internal development or something that their customers need.
Yeah, let's dive into the commercial adoption a little bit more, if you can. You know, we recently did an interview for an upcoming episode of this podcast with Niels Jakobsen. So Niels, he founded Mobile Industrial Robots back in, I believe it was 2013, very well-known AMRs zipping around warehouses and other logistics-like facilities. They use ROS. Niels now is the CEO of a Danish startup called Capra Robotics. They're developing an outdoor mobile robotics platform. And you know, he was really raving about ROS2. I think a lot, if I remember right, a lot of it was about the DDS and some of the security features that are now available in ROS2. Are you seeing from a commercial adoption standpoint what you guys kind of expected as you baked in some of these features? Has it gone better than you have expected? What more can you tell us about that?
Sure. And I'm happy to hear that, you know, somebody who ran as prominent a company as Mirror is now back at it and using ROS2. I actually didn't know that. So I'm happy to hear that. That's one of the things about doing open source development is in a lot of cases, you find out how people are using your software kind of by accident when they tell you or somebody else tells you about it. So that I'm happy to hear that. We're seeing significant commercial adoption of ROS2, you know, and I think where it's happening is it's in those mission, those domains that I mentioned where you've got these mission critical applications, and it's in domains where you've got someone who is starting a new project. I think that's the place where if you're starting something new, it totally makes sense to start, just start with ROS2. I think where you've mentioned encouraging adoption is people who or deploy products that run ROS1. And that's just because there's a necessary cost of change. There's some effort that they'd have to put in to migrate from ROS1 to ROS2. And very reasonably, they need to believe that there's a benefit on the other side of that that justifies that cost. That is coming, but that's happening more slowly. So on the side where people are starting largely new efforts, I think we can look at the commercial success of or the commercial opportunities from companies like Apex AI. I mentioned that we designed ROS2 from the start so that it would be amenable to certification. And just last year, I think it was, Apex was able to take their ROS2-based product through an ISO 26262 certification with TÜV in Germany and get it certified as I believe it's an out-of-context functional safety certification. So that really, that's a validation of all that effort that we put in. They were able to take ROS2 and you know, to be fair, make quite some changes to it and some additions to it to make it into their own product, but they were able to take that through a certification process. And presumably the next step for them is to get that out onto the road as the software platform for future self-driving vehicles. So that's one example. We also see examples in spaces where you've got some constraints on how the system runs. And so examples of that are UAVs. So Auterion is a company in out of Zurich. They in addition to their drone business, they're also the primary developers of the PX4 autopilot. And they've been working for a couple of years now. We've been helping them to tightly integrate PX4 with ROS2. So now it's they're fielding, they and their other users in the PX4 community are fielding drones into production that have ROS2 built in at the lowest level so that they're handling the communication between the microcontroller that does the autopilot functions and a kind of traditionally called a co-pilot computer that does the higher level autonomy. A similar setup is happening in underwater vehicles. You can look at mission robotics where they're building these small underwater uncrewed underwater vessels, and they're building those all based on ROS2. And those are some use cases that you can actually see in a paper that we recently published in the Science Robotics Journal.
That was a great piece, by the way. We'll make sure that we link to that in the show notes when we publish this. So for folks listening to this who might not have read the science.
Well, thanks. And a ton of credit for that goes to the lead author on that, Steve Misensky from Samsung. He was really the ringleader who had the idea and dragged the rest of us along.
Yeah, he does a lot with navigation, right?
He does. Yeah, he's the ROS navigator, I think is what he calls himself. So he's spearheading the effort and really both leading and taking care of the nav stack in ROS2.
Yeah, I think we had him talk in a webcast that we did maybe during the height of COVID a year ago or so, something like that. But I think in your answer just a couple of minutes ago, you touched on the migration process, which I think is an important point. You know, we've talked to a couple of AMR companies who I think, you know, the last time we talked about this, they were still using ROS 1. They weren't really sure about migrating to ROS 2 at the time that we talked to them. Are there best practices or things that these companies should have in place when looking to migrate to ROS 2? Or how do you guys help companies make that transition?
Sure. So, you know, like with any open source project, we start by helping with documentation and tooling. So there's a migration guide. I can't promise it'll cover every use case, but there's a migration guide that folks can go look at to give them some tips. There are some examples of systems that exist in ROS 1 and ROS 2. And so you can look at the before and after and see what was necessary to be done. There is a bridge that allows you to translate between at runtime between ROS 1 and ROS 2. So you have the opportunity to do the migration piece by piece. If you have a ROS 1 system, you can go through and update components from ROS 1 to ROS 2 and still have a running system as you go through it instead of having to do it all at once. I don't want to minimize the effort. And people always ask, how much effort is it? It really depends on how your current system is implemented. At one end, if you have, if you've really deeply dug into the ROS 1 APIs and taken advantage of some of the less well used parts of that API, the ROS 1 API is quite big. There's a lot of surface area there that you might've touched. If you're using a lot of that, it could take a lot of effort to get from there to ROS 2. If you've kept your code kind of more self-contained and you're generally just using the publish, subscribe, service call parameter APIs in ROS 1, then that's actually really straightforward to move over. Most people, I think, lie somewhere in between. And that's something that we've actually helped a number of our customers do that move from ROS 1 to ROS 2. So there's, you know, if a company out there wants to make that migration, I don't feel like they either know or have the time internally to do it. They could reach out to us or other companies who would be happy to help them with that.
Well, I mean, and I said it's all documented, but is there a big chunk of that API from ROS 1 that was deprecated in the new release?
Yes, there were some things, there were some conceptual changes that make it so that it, depending on how deeply you were using that ROS 1 API, the concepts might be different. And so it's not so much deprecation, there's just parts that are different now. Mm. And so it takes a little bit more effort to make those changes.
Mm. Let me ask you a slightly different question, but for folks that are, you know, listening maybe for the first time, we just talked about the evolution from ROS 1 to ROS 2. There's also the idea out there, it's another working group for ROS Industrial. And maybe you can tell us, you know, what is ROS Industrial? How's that project related or that consortium related to ROS and the folks that are there? And you know, how does Open Robotics play in that consortium?
Absolutely. Yeah, we are longtime members and big supporters of ROS Industrial. I remember when Sean Edwards, who was at Southwest Research Institute at the time, came and had a kind of extended working stay at Willow Garage in the early days of ROS. And he came in with this, you know, a background in working with industrial robots, by which I mean, you know, sort of medium to large robot arms that are in work cells doing pick and place type tasks. And he came in with a proposition that was frankly surprising to us, because we, again, at that time, we were coming at it from the angle of we're going to build a platform for this newfangled generation of robots that's coming out. Things like the PR2, mobile manipulation platforms, mobile robots that are going to be free roaming in factories. And Sean came in from this background of really these robots that have been well established and, as far as I knew, worked perfectly well for decades in factories, right? These are the kinds of robots that they weld cars, they do a ton of work in kind of classic industrial settings. But what he came to work with us was that the problem they had at Southwest Research or SWIRI was every time they did an application and they were moving from, say, a FANUC robot to an ABB robot, they had to rewrite the application entirely because the embedded programming environment that was provided for each robot was just different. Mm-hmm. And what they wanted was basically a common language, a common platform to allow them to build applications where they could use any of those robots. And they saw in Ross the opportunity for that. So Sean came, worked at Willow Garage for a while with us, and then went back and got with, you know, support from his management at Swery, they started what became the Ross Industrial Consortium. And so what they do today is, I mean, they do a lot. I don't want to give them short shrift. And in fact, you should get Matt Robinson on this podcast to talk about it in more detail. But from a technical perspective, what they're doing is really building the core features that you need to take Ross as it exists. Ross Industrial is not a different distribution or anything like that. It's an additional set of packages that go with Ross to make it, for example, talk to the kinds of robots, the kinds of sensors, the kinds of end effectors that you have in an industrial setting, and also provide you with the algorithms and the tools that you need to make those robots do what are really advanced factory automation type tasks. So they're providing, I think of them as a community of interest within the overall Ross ecosystem, where they're making sure that if you like Ross and you want to use it with an industrial robot, all the bits and pieces you need are there. And of course, there's more than that. They're also bringing, in order to drive that development, they're bringing together all the stakeholders. The Ross Industrial Consortium counts as members, the robot manufacturers, the system integrators, the end users, industrial consortium.
Wow. Yeah. I think that's a great answer. And that really, I think, clearly differentiates now, you know, when folks hear that term Ross Industrial, you think industrial robots and robot manipulators. And I guess that even it applies now as we start to put, you know, those types of manipulators on top of autonomous mobile robots, right? If they're both running a version of Ross, then that integration should be pretty straightforward.
Exactly. And that, you know, mobile manipulation is, it's coming. People have been talking about it for, I mean, like I said, Ross got started by building the PR2, which was a very much a speculative R&D platform over a decade ago. But now you've got a real demand. I mean, now you've got, for a long time in factories, warehouses, other settings like that, you've had robot arms doing tasks. Now you've got mobile robots that are very reliably roaming around, and your people want to bring those together. And it's going to be natural that those combined mobile manipulation systems are almost certainly going to run Ross.
We wanted to ask you about Fog Ross. I know this is a new feature, I believe, in the latest release that we talked about a little bit ago for Ross 2. You know, fog robotics is certainly a term or a theme or a concept that the great Ken Goldberg has been talking about for a number of years now. We've talked about that with him a little bit, but from my understanding, it helps bring cloud computing to the robot operating system. I know TechCrunch just did a little piece on this about Fog Ross. For those who are unfamiliar, can you just give us a little quick insight into what Fog Ross is and you know, how it will benefit folks who are developing different types of robots?
Sure. And we've coordinated closely with Ken and his group at Berkeley and others who put Fogross together. But I would actually take the history back a little bit further and attribute this idea really to James Kuffner back at the time he was working at Google. This would have been like 2008, 2009. And he was promoting an idea that at the time they called cloud robotics. And the proposition is really the same with Fogross and Fog Robotics. The idea is that as we get more robots out in the world, they're necessarily, especially the mobile robots, are necessarily going to be, as they say, size, weight, and power constrained. So as we get more robots out there, we want lots of them. We want them to be reliable. But we also need them to be reasonably inexpensive and have long battery lives. And that generally means that you can't put the most powerful computer that you want on that robot. But that robot might have to do tasks that require a lot of computation. So what do? You do what we all do. You offload that computation to the cloud. And this is how, you know, this is how your Alexa works. This is how Siri works. You take a lot of that work and have it happen up at the cloud, and then you get an answer back. So the scenario here is that you've got a robot where it's got a relatively modest computer on board, but it's able to access, say, a perception pipeline that can run in the cloud that has been trained to help that robot do the task it's going to do. And that requires some compute power that it doesn't have access to locally. And this has always been possible. I mean, the cloud has existed, the robots have existed. There's a way to get data from here to there, right? That's it. This has not never been an impossible thing, but it's not also never been an easy thing. And that's what Fogross is bringing to the table. What that group has done is really very nicely integrated ROS2 with, I think their current system is shown working with AWS, although I imagine they could also work with other cloud providers. And they're able to seamlessly be able to shift the computation from running locally on the robot to running in the cloud. And here they're really taking advantage of the inherently distributed nature of the architecture that's within ROS, is that we split things up into nodes and those nodes communicate with each other over well-defined interfaces. So what they're able to do is have those interfaces bridge the gap between the robot and the cloud and be able to move the computation, to be able to locate the computation wherever you need it to be to get the task done.
Well, and I think, we're going in some interesting places here today, Brian. This is really fascinating to sort of peel back the onion layers of what ROS is capable of. And we talk about all of the different capabilities that different systems might need, right, to run. And I guess there's another sort of feature that I wanted to ask you about that some on the call might be interested in related to what you just said, which is sort of the other end of cloud or fog robotics, which is sort of this micro ROS kernel as well. Tell us a little bit about, what types of applications that's sort of targeting or optimized for, and how that compares to what you just discussed on the cloud side.
Sure. Yeah. So you're absolutely right that in robotics, you have a need for the whole spectrum of computation from a data center scale compute and data access in the cloud down through what we conventionally think of as a kind of a normal computer, something that looks like what you would have in a laptop or a workstation. But it goes further than that down to what we generally call microcontrollers. So these are smaller computers. They're still way more powerful than computers that any of us had growing up, but now we call them microcontrollers. And they're generally the hallmark of what we would call a microcontroller is that it doesn't have a full operating system on it. It's a more stripped down system. It tends to be, you've got fewer processing cores. You've got, you might have slower clock rates, although that is a different question. And you've just got fewer resources there. And the reason that you use a microcontroller is that it is physically small. It can be inexpensive. It can be low power. Also, it can be made to run in, it's easier to make a microcontroller run in a way that's deterministic. For example, you might need to meet real-time compute guarantees. And a great example of needing that is in drones. So if you go buy a UAV, a drone, any kind of consumer drone, almost certainly going to have a microcontroller in there that's running an autopilot. And that's a chunk of code that's taking data from the sensors. It'll be a gyro accelerometer, and taking in the commands of what you want the thing to do. And then it's commanding the motors. And that loop has to turn over very reliably at a relatively high rate. You can't, get lost in the middle of it, go do something else, and then come back and decide to tell the rotors what to do because you'll crash. So it's been long been the case that you've had microcontrollers play that particular role in robots. But what has that kind of domain of software development has always been completely divorced from the ROS level. So you would generally, you had people who were specialized at building microcontroller software, and then you had people building ROS software, and there wasn't a great way to mix them together. In ROS 1, there is a package called ROS Serial that allows you to kind of bridge between them, but it was never that easy to use. And so one of our design features in ROS 2 was to make it so that we could take the same message formats, at least the same APIs or very similar APIs, and maybe even some of the code, and have it actually run on the microcontroller so we can have a more seamless transition between those two compute domains. Mm. And it's MicroROS is the result of that. This is really led by the team over at Aprosema, where they've, together with Bosch and some other partners, where they've been taking the ROS2 ecosystem and stripping away parts and coming up with a set of APIs and a code base that looks a lot like ROS2 does on a laptop or a workstation, but it runs in a microcontroller footprint. footprint. And that means that then you could take a system again, like a drone, and you can have that autopilot that runs on the microcontroller, but now you can talk to it from your co-pilot computer where you're doing your higher level autonomy. And the two of them are basically running ROS2. There's differences beyond that, but you're basically able to take, it's just like that cloud setting. You're taking those, that familiar distributed flexible architecture and pushing it up to the cloud in the case of FogRoS, but then pushing it down to the microcontroller in the case of MicroRoS.
I guess in a related sort of topic as well, we're sort of meandering down the rabbit hole here with you. We reported back in September about your, you know, sort of ongoing relationship with NVIDIA and ROS2 around that. So how are you working with companies like NVIDIA and, of course, you know, all of the capabilities that they offer for their embedded systems as well to hook, you know, deeper into ROS and ROS2 now?
Yeah, so this was and this is really just a perfect example of a kind of a commercial partnership engagement that we do as a company, where NVIDIA, we were talking with NVIDIA, and they basically said to us, we've got these Jetson single board computers that, you know, you and probably most of our listeners are familiar with, and they want people to build robots around those Jetson computers, and lots of people do build robots around them. And they know that those people are probably going to use ROS on that hardware. And so they want it to work well together. And the problem that they had was that ROS, in particular ROS2, as it existed when we started working together, it really was not taking advantage of the hardware acceleration capabilities that is in those computers. So the Jetsons famously have a combination of a CPU and a GPU with shared memory between them. And if you use it right, you're able to get really high performance compute to handle tasks like perception. So say you take in some camera data, you want to run it through multiple stages of a perception pipeline. If you're able to take that and hand it off to the GPU, you can have it go through those stages on the GPU, and then you can get the answer back later to the CPU. And that's where, for example, your motion planner runs. And so you get the answer from what the camera saw, and then you decide what to do and make a plan. What the problem was is that the way that we had built ROS2, we hadn't thought about that particular use case. And so they really couldn't squeeze all the performance out of that pipeline that they wanted. So they came to us, and we worked together, co-designed and co-developed some changes to ROS2 to make it possible to do that. And I think Gordon from NVIDIA reported like a 7x speed up in those kinds of use cases. So it was just a great example where they had a need for this improvement in ROS to really showcase all the capabilities of their product. And we work together, we got those improvements done, they get pushed upstream, so they're available to everybody. And that means everybody who gets a Jetson now with ROS2, starting with Humble, I believe, is able to take advantage of this huge hardware acceleration capability. And I'll just say just one more point on that. While this absolutely was a great partnership with NVIDIA, those changes are not, they don't have to only be used on NVIDIA hardware. So some of the architectural changes that we made along the way, they allow for us to make that same acceleration capability accessible on other systems where you've got, say, an FPGA or some other kind of hardware acceleration system.
I do want to switch gears a little bit here and discuss what it is that you spoke at length about during your keynote session at our Robotics Summit and Expo, which of course was interoperability. You really gave us the skinny on interoperability and how open robotics is helping bring interoperability and really scale those capabilities to the industry as a whole. We'll get into, you know, specifically what you guys are doing with Open RMF here in a minute. But can you just take a step back and just sort of give us the state of the state of interoperability in the robotics industry? How much of it exists? You know, how long do we have to go?
Sure. So interoperability is a topic that you can think about at a lot of different levels. And in a sense, that what we've been doing with ROS all of these years is defining interoperability frameworks. So if you think about when people build an AMR using ROS, they're probably putting some sensors in there, like some cameras and some LIDARs. And that's one of the core advantages of ROS is that it defines clean interfaces to those systems. So you you can choose a LiDAR from SICK, or you can choose a LiDAR from Hokuyo or from RP LiDAR, and they all present their data in the same way. And that gives you as the AMR developer a lot of freedom to decide what your sensor suite ought to be. And it should cause few or no changes in your code. So that's kind of how ROS has always been architected. That's one of the big advantages of using is it makes within a robot, it makes the different pieces that really are functionally equivalent be interoperable with each other. So that we've kind of tackled that. The new frontier, which is really exciting, and that's what I was talking about at your event in Boston, is taking that idea of interoperability and scaling it up to cover all of the robots that are in, say, a large facility. So, you know, you've got some really successful AMR companies out there who will put relatively large deployments of robots into facilities to do material transport, for example. And that works great, but those vendors tend to build a fleet management system that will only control their robots, which makes sense, right? They're their robots. They build a totally vertically integrated system that gives access to their robots. The problem comes when basically any facility that's large enough, you're going to need robots from more than one vendor. And because it doesn't matter how big your vendor is, they might make the AMRs you want, but they probably don't also make the floor cleaning robots that you want and the security patrolling robots that you want. And the robot, you know, if you're in a consumer environment like an airport, they don't make the robots, the mobile kiosk robots that help passengers find their way to their gate. So in the end, any large facility is going to end up having a heterogeneous collection of robots. And those robots generally are not interoperable because even though internally many of them happen to be implemented using ROS, they, on the outside, they're all kind of tied into these vendor-specific fleet management systems and interfaces. And that causes a real headache for the facility operators when they want to bring these systems together from different vendors. They really end up really tightly constrained. They have to make sure they only, you know, one vendor uses one quarter, one vendor uses another quarter. They end up doing crazy things like allocating an entire elevator bank to one vendor's robots, and then they might run out of elevator banks before they get to the next robot. So what we've been doing over the last few years, this would have been since 2018, we've been working closely with customers in the healthcare sector, in particular in Singapore, where they are really quickly adopting automation. They want more and more and more automation in their hospitals, but they have this problem of how do we get these heterogeneous systems to work together? We've been working together with them to develop a system we now call OpenRMF, or Open Robotics Middleware Framework. And basically, all we're doing is taking the concepts we've long used in ROS, and this is all built on ROS 2, and scaling it up to describe not the pieces within a robot, but the robots themselves, or even the fleets of robots. So if you imagine if you've got a few different fleets of robots in your building, each fleet has some capabilities. It's able to tell you something about where the robots in its fleet are going. You might be able to tell it something about where you want those robots to go instead, or maybe you can tell it to have those robots pause and wait for another robot to cross at an intersection. So we can define these interfaces to these fleets and these common messages, and then we can bring all that data back somewhere where we can, for example, show you a common dashboard that tells you where all the robots are in your multi-floor facility, no matter who made those robots. We can have those robots share access to common resources like corridors, like elevator banks, like charging stations. And it may seem like a relatively minor thing, but this ability to share space is huge. You have to think about these facilities they're very, very space constrained. And so it's a real barrier to entry to adopting automation for these facility operators to be able to have, they in order to get over that barrier, they need to have a way to use that space efficiently.
So what are you seeing from the robot vendors? Are they, from what I understand, from talking to a few people, there was some, maybe hesitancy or pushback to interoperability just because they thought they had to give up some of their, code or something to, enable this interoperability with other companies. And then, as we continue to talk to more people in the industry, they say, well, these vendors really need to get on board because there is no one company out there that makes a robot to perform all the tasks that a company needs at the end of the day. So it's in the vendor's best interest to get on board with this if they want to sell their product at the end of the day. Is that what you've seen? You know, are robotics companies becoming more open to this?
You know, I'm reminded a lot of what happened in the early days of Ross Industrial, which I mentioned earlier. You know, Sean and team were, they had this idea of building this common framework that could talk to different industrial robots. The industrial robot manufacturers, their responses varied a lot. I have to hand a lot of credit to Yaskawa Motoman for being really at the forefront of that effort and saying, we want our systems to be interoperable with the other systems. There were some other big players in that market who in the early days really resisted. They said, no, we have a perfectly good way of doing business. We don't see an advantage to being interoperable with other vendors who we see as competitors. But in the end, they were pretty much all pulled along by customer demand, which is exactly what you mentioned. In the end, you've got customers who your robots might be great, but they're really going to marry your robots together with robots from other vendors, and you need a way for them to work together. So, and our experience to date with OpenRMF has mirrored that story about Ross Industrial, which is that some vendors jump right in and say, this sounds great. We see an advantage here. We see a way to break into a market that we wouldn't otherwise get into. And then we see other vendors who are just kind of instinctively hesitant, as you mentioned, and say, wait a minute, am I divulging too much if I get into this? And to be clear, we tell them that you should divulge as much as you feel comfortable. We're not talking about taking your code and suddenly making it open source, although of course, philosophically, we think that'd be a great idea. But what we're telling them is what we need is a way to talk to your system. We need to get a way to get some data out of it. We'd like to be able to give some guidance to it to influence what your fleet is doing. And there's a spectrum of control there. And I don't think it'll be too hard to find the right balance that the vendors are going to be comfortable with that still exposes enough to a higher level system where we can get that efficiency and interoperability that their customers ultimately need.
So coming back, Brian, to your prior comment about the various mobile robots that might be in a facility from various vendors, what are your thoughts or how are you guys working with mass robotics and you know, the concept of the mass robotics interoperability standard that's, you know, emerged in the last year?
Yeah, so our folks have been participating in the meetings where the mass robotics team are talking about the interoperability spec. I think we've contributed some ideas. One of the things, as soon as we heard about it, we'd actually already been working on OpenRMF for quite a while when we first became aware of the mass robotics effort. And, you know, just like with Ross, it's never a question of should you use Ross or something else. It's really it's Ross and something else. And I think that the same is true with OpenRMF. What we said was, oh, you guys have you've come up with a message definition. The first version of it is, you know, it's pretty minor. It's there's a set of messages that allow you to report the poses of robots up to a system, for example, to show on a dashboard. It's a great first step. And we immediately just added a bridge to interoperate with that. So we said, okay, now if there are robots in the facility that are sending those messages out, we can consume them and we can bring them into the OpenRMF software to show on a dashboard or incorporate into traffic planning, which is one of the key capabilities in OpenRMF. So I'd say I'm really happy to see others in the industry caring about this topic and wanting to do it in an open way, which is how the mass robotics spec has been developed. I think that's great. I think the spec itself is that we need to go further than that. That it's not enough to just write down, here are some messages that we want everybody to send and receive. I think that gets you part of the way there. But if you look at what we've done with OpenRMF, we've gone much, much further. I mean, that just having the messages is the first step, but it's really then about building the common tools, the user interfaces, and the algorithms, which include a whole bunch of decisions about behavior and how you define how you interpret the semantics of those messages that are coming in. You really have to build all that stuff as well, because that's where the customer value comes from, is from using those tools. The messages themselves are actually the end customer doesn't get any value out of those directly. You need to build the rest of that stuff. And also from our experience with Ross over the past you know, decade plus has been that no set of messages that you sit in a room and define on a whiteboard are going to be perfect. What you need to do is actually go out and use them by, for example, building traffic control and task allocation algorithms on top, improving them in use, and then evolving them over time. That's why, you know, we sometimes say that ROS is a de facto standard, but I always put that de facto qualifier in there because I'm not personally a big fan of declaring standards. I think that it's much better to start and basically do what you think works best, get a bunch of people involved, get them using it, and evolve it over time. I don't think there's actually that much value in a lot of cases for the systems that we're talking about to officially call it a standard.
Well, and I think one of the things that I saw the actual demo at the AMR conference in Memphis, one of the things that wasn't shown there was, you know, a common map, right? So certainly they were maybe sharing that they were in certain regions, but I know that was still a hard problem from a proprietary perspective to share maps, you know, what a map of a facility. I would imagine that becomes much simpler if there's a common function, you know, in ROS that keeps the map and that's what's shared, because then you can put everybody in the same universe, right?
That's a really important point, that each robot fleet is going to have its own map. It's going to have its own coordinate system. The maps, you know, two robots map the same space, they're going to end up with different maps. They're going to have different conventions. So that's a fair amount of the tooling that we've built in OpenRMF. There's a component in there called the traffic editor. And it is, it just, the name kind of doesn't speak completely about what it does. It's really a set of tools that allow you to take maps from different robots, if you have access to them, as well as, for example, architectural floor plans for a building, overlay them, line up, create correspondences, and then do semi-automated scaling and warping and rotating in order to line those maps up so you can establish then a common, you basically what you're doing is establishing a set of transforms that allow you to get between all those maps so that then when you can you can have an overall map concept for the building, and then you can decide, you know, I want this robot to go over into that room, then you can translate that to the map coordinates for the fleet that has that robot in it. So we have that tooling on the front end, and then the traffic editor part of it is allowing you to, in that common frame, then designate where the robot lanes are, what the speed limits are, what the no-go zones are, things like that. This is still, it's an evolving topic, and it is, as I mentioned earlier, different robot vendors have different levels of comfort with sharing information like maps. I think it'll only get better over time. I remember a few years ago, I was at a meeting with, there was a major automotive company there, and they were basically making this argument that I've been making, which is we, you know, in our factories, we need more than one kind of robot, and we need them to work together, and we need them to work in a common frame. We need them to share maps. And there was a representative from a major AMR vendor there saying, we're not sharing our maps. Our ability to make great maps is one of our differentiators. We're not going to let anybody else see our maps. And I can understand that perspective, but I don't think that's going to hold for very long. I think that what we're necessarily going to see is it's going to become a requirement to have access to that data. So exactly, so you can build these interoperability systems.
I know you have to get going here in a few minutes, so just a couple more quick questions. I got a chuckle from one of the questions that you received from our audience after your keynote. And I don't know if we need to clarify this at all. Hopefully you got a chuckle out of it. I don't know. But somebody asked you, I think this person actually thought that everybody who works at Open Robotics just forgoes ticking home a paycheck and works out of the kindness of their hearts to open source all this great technology that you guys are building. But in fact, that is not the case. You guys actually make some money, right? OpenRMF is one of those ways. You talked about the Singapore initiative that you guys did. Is that a common question that you guys get? Like, what are some of the ways that Open Robotics makes money?
Yeah, surprise, surprise, we have customers. It is, you know, it is a misunderstanding. Hopefully it's not too common, but it's not the first time I've heard that question either. I think we, you know, for better or for worse, we've done a good job of hiding the sausage making and just presenting to the community as if this open source code just, you know, emerges from our heads fully formed and at no cost. But of course, we have a team of 50 people who are, you know, and many of them are Bay Area software engineers. It's not an inexpensive proposition. But we've also never taken any investment. And to be clear, while our parent company is a foundation, we by no means sit on an endowment. The way this whole thing works is we have customers and we get revenue from customers and we use that to fund the operation. And what the customers are buying from us is largely R&D services. We got our start working with government agencies like DARPA and NASA, who we still work with, but increasingly we work with companies. We mentioned the NVIDIA partnership earlier, and that was a great example of NVIDIA funding us to make this improvement to ROS that they needed for their purposes. But the result was 100% open source. And that's really the kinds of engagements that we look for, is where we find customers in government and in industry who have a need to extend, adapt, apply our platforms, ROS, Gazebo, OpenRMF. And the sweet spot for us is when all or nearly all of that work can go upstream as contributions to the open platform. And that's really our specialty.
Is there a robot or an application that sticks out to you most that uses ROS? You know, a couple of years ago, I think it was somebody on your communications team told me that, you know, some autonomous vehicle companies were, you know, use ROS in some way, shape or form, which was news to me. But is there one that sticks out to you over the years? I mean, I'm sure the PR2 or, you know, Turtlebot or something like that, but is there a robot or an application that was enabled by ROS that is more memorable to you than some of the others?
Well, I'm a sucker for space applications, so I have to go there and just point out that right now on the International Space Station, there are free-flying robots called Astrobees that were developed at NASA Ames. So they've got fans inside. They fly around inside the, you know, zero G environment of the space station and help the astronauts do things. And those all run ROS. They're running ROS on Ubuntu onboard the space station. And that's a great example of something. While we have worked with NASA on lots of things, we didn't do anything at all to help NASA. I mean, other than provide ROS and Gazebo, which they use heavily for testing, they did all that themselves. I actually found out that those were running ROS, I think, after they launched, which we had a presentation from someone at ROSCON 2018 in Madrid, I think it was. And yeah, so we've got, I mean, having robots in space running ROS is pretty cool.
We'll have to get you back on because we could talk to you for hours just about, and we were supposed to bring this up, and I think we just got sidetracked about space ROS and the Robonaut 2 and all this stuff. You went to space camp as a kid, right? I mean, we'll have to get you back on to talk.
Sounds
about
good.
What you guys are doing with Blue Origin, NASA on actual space ROS. There's a whole platform that you guys are building there. So I guess just final thoughts from you quick, because I know, again, you got to go. What's next for you guys? When's ROS 3 coming out? No. What's next for you guys?
Well, what's coming up, I frankly hope we don't have a need to get to ROS 3, but what's coming up next for us is we've just put out the ROS 2 Humble release, as we talked about. So we're still helping the community put all their new features into that. Things like FogRoS, that NVIDIA acceleration, we're helping people get up to speed and using that. We've got the Gazebo Garden release coming out in September, and that's going to have a whole bunch of new functionality, including, again, some work that we've done together with NVIDIA for better interoperability with their Isaacson platform. And other than that, we continue to just be working with our customers, helping them to use all this software across pretty much every robot domain you can imagine.
Well, hey, tremendous work. Thank you again for doing this podcast. Thanks for doing the opening keynote at our show. Thanks for all that you and everybody at Open Robotics does to continue to help folks drive this industry forward. And best of luck with everything. Please keep us posted. Happy to share any news and developments that come out of open robotics and ROS and Gazebo and all that. So Brian Gerke, co-founder and CEO of Open Robotics, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
All right. I want to thank Brian Gerke from Open Robotics for joining us on the show today. Before I let you go, I want to remind you that the call for presentations has been extended. We've been getting a lot of great submissions for RoboBusiness and the Field Robotics Engineering Forum that we're running in Santa Clara, California this October. But we've also extended the call for presentation a couple more weeks to give you an opportunity if you've been waiting to submit that. So again, I'm not sure if we're going to extend it again. We need to get the agenda pulled together and it's filling in nicely. But if you had an idea and wanted to present it at the upcoming events in October, now is the time to do that. New episodes of the Robot Report podcast drop each week. We're now available on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe, leave us a rating, give us a review. And if you don't feel comfortable doing that, drop Steve or I an email with your feedback or your input or anything you'd like us to pursue here on the podcast. On behalf of Steve Crow, who will be back next week, I'm Mike Oitzman. Have a great July 4th weekend, everyone.